8. By midnight in Chicago, the third-floor conference room was set up as a command center. FBI technicians had swarmed all evening, running phone lines into the room and installing computer terminals in a line down the center of the hardwood table. Now at midnight, it was dark and cool and quiet. Shiny blackness outside the wall of glass. No scramble to decide which side of the table was better. Nobody had gone home. There were 17 agents sprawled in the leather chairs. Even the bureau lawyer was still there. No real reason for that, but the guy was feeling the same triple-layered response they all were. The bureau looks after its own. That was layer number one. The Chicago field office looks after Holly Johnson. That was layer number two. Not just because of her connections. That had nothing to do with it. Holly was Holly. And layer number three was what McGrath wanted, McGrath got. If McGrath was worried about Holly, then they all were worried. And they all were going to stay worried until she was found, safe and sound. So they were all still there, quiet and worried. Until McGrath came loudly and cheerfully into the room, making a big entrance, smoking like his life depended on it.
"Good news, people. Listen up, listen up," he called out.
He dodged his way through to the head of the table. Murmuring died into sudden silence. 18 pairs of eyes followed him.
"We found her," he called out. "We found her, okay? She's safe and well. Panic's over, folks. We can all relax now."
18 voices started talking all at once, all asking the same urgent questions. McGrath held his hands up for quiet, like a nominee at a rally.
"She's in the hospital," he said. "What happened is her surgeon got a window for this afternoon he wasn't expecting. He called her, she went right over, and they took her straight to the OR. She's fine, she's convalescing, and she's embarrassed as all hell for the fuss she's caused."
The 18 voices started up again, and McGrath let them rumble on for a moment. Then he held his hands up again.
"So, panic over, right?"
he called out again, smiling. The rumbling got lighter in tone as relief fueled the voices.
"So, people, home to bed," McGrath said. "Full working day tomorrow, right? But thanks for being here, from me and from Holly. Means a lot to her. Brogan and Milosevic, you stay a while. Share out her workload for the rest of the week. The rest of you, good night, sleep well, and thanks again, gentlemen."
15 agents and the lawyer smiled and yawned and stood up, jostled cheerfully and noisily out of the room. McGrath and Brogan and Milosevic were left scattered in random seats, far from each other. McGrath walked over in the sudden silence to the door, closed it quietly, turned back and faced the other two.
"That was all bullshit," he said, "as I'm sure you both guessed."
Brogan and Milosevic just stared at him.
"Webster called me," McGrath said, "and I'm sure you can both guess why. Major, major D.C. involvement. They're going apeshit down there. VIP kidnap, right? Webster's been given personal responsibility. He wants total secrecy and minimum numbers. He wants everybody up here off this case right now, except me plus a team of two. My choice. I picked the two of you because you know her best, so it's the three of us. We deal direct with Webster, and we don't talk to anybody else at all, okay?"
Brogan stared at him and nodded. Milosevic nodded in turn. They knew they were the obvious choices for the job, but to be chosen by McGrath for any reason was an honor. They knew it, and they knew McGrath knew they knew it, so they nodded again, more firmly. Then there was silence for a long moment. McGrath's cigarette smoke mingled with the silence up near the ceiling. The clock on the wall ticked around toward 12:30.
"Okay," Brogan said finally. "So, what now?"
"We work all night is what," McGrath said. "All day, all night, every night until we find her."
He glanced at the two of them, reviewed his choices. An adequate team, he thought. A good mixture. Brogan was older, drier, a pessimist. A compact man with a tidy, ordered approach, laced with enough imagination to make him useful. An untidy private life, with a girlfriend and a couple of ex-wives somewhere, all costing him big bucks and worry, but it never interfered with his work. Milosevic was younger, less intuitive, flashier, but solid.
a permanent sidekick, which was not necessarily a fault. A weakness for big, expensive four-wheel drives. But everybody needs some kind of a hobby. Both of them were medium-term Bureau veterans with mileage on their clocks and scalps on their belts. Both of them were focused, and neither of them ever bitched about the work or the hours or the salary, which made them just about unique. An adequate team. They were new to Chicago, but this investigation was not going to stay in Chicago. McGrath was just about sure of that.
"Milo, you figure out her movements," he said. "Every step, every minute from 12 noon.
Milosevic nodded vaguely, like he was already lost in doing that.
"Brogan, background checks," McGrath said. "We need to find some reason here."
Brogan nodded dourly, like he knew the reason was going to be the beginning and the end of the whole thing.
"I start with the old guy?" he asked.
"Obviously," McGrath said. "That's what I would do."
"Okay, which one?" Brogan asked.
"Whichever one," McGrath replied. "Your choice."
1,702 miles away, another executive decision had been taken. A decision about the third carpenter. The employer drove back to the white building in the crew chief's pickup. The third carpenter had finished up stocking the tools, and he took a step forward when he saw the vehicle approaching. Then he stopped in puzzlement when he saw the huge figure at the wheel. He stood, uncertain, while the employer pulled up at the curb and heaved himself out.
"Okay," the employer said to him.
"Where are the guys?"
the carpenter asked.
"Something came up," the employer said.
"Problem?"
the guy asked. He went quiet because he was thinking about his share of the price. A minority share, for sure, because he was the junior guy. But a minority share of that price was still more cash than he'd seen in a long time.
"You got a saw there?"
the employer asked. The guy just looked at him.
"Dumb question, right?"
the employer said.
"You're a carpenter, and I'm asking you if you got a saw. Just show me your best saw."
The guy stood still for a moment. Then he ducked down and pulled a power saw from the stack of tools. A big thing in dull metal, wicked circular blade, fresh sawdust caked all around it.
"Crosscut?"
the employer asked.
"Good for ripping through real tough stuff?"
The guy nodded.
"It does the job," he said cautiously. "Okay, here's the deal," the employer said. "We need a demonstration."
"Of the saw?" the guy asked.
"Of the room,"
the employer said.
"The room?"
the guy repeated.
"Supposed to be nobody can get out of it," the employer said. "That's the idea behind it, right?"
"You designed it," the guy said.
"But did you build it right?" the employer said. "That's what I'm asking here. We need a trial run, a demonstration, to prove it serves its purpose."
"Okay, how?" the guy asked.
"You go in there," the employer said. "See if you can get out by morning. You built it, right? So you know all the weak spots. If anybody can get out, you can. That's for damn sure, right?"
The guy was quiet for a long moment, trying to understand.
"And if I can?" he asked.
The employer shrugged.
"Then you don't get paid," he said, "because you didn't build it right."
The guy went quiet again, wondering if the employer was joking.
"You spot the flaw in my logic?"
the employer asked.
"The way you're figuring it right now, it's in your interest just to sit there on your ass all night. Then tomorrow you say to me, 'No, sir, I couldn't get out of there. No, sir, not at all.'"
The carpenter laughed a short, nervous laugh.
"That's how I was thinking," he said. "So what you need is an incentive," the employer said. "Understand? To make sure you try real hard to get out?"
The carpenter glanced up at the blanked-off second-story corner. When he glanced back down, there was a dull, black automatic in the employer's hand.
"There's a sack in the truck,"
the employer said.
"Go get it, okay?"
The carpenter just looked around, astonished. The employer pointed a gun at his head.
"Get the sack,"
he said quietly. There was nothing in the pickup bed. There was a burlap sack on the passenger seat, wrapped into a package maybe a foot and a half long. It was heavy. It felt like reaching into a freezer at the market and pulling out a side of pig.
"Open it up," the employer called. "Take a look."
The carpenter peeled back the burlap. First thing he saw was a finger, icy white because the blood had drained, yellow workman's calluses standing out, big and obvious.
"I'm going to put you in the room now," the employer called to him. "You don't get out by morning, I'm going to do that to you, okay? With your own damn saw, because mine went dull doing those."
9. Reacher lay quietly on the dirty straw in his stall in the cow barn. Not asleep, but his body was shut down to the point where he might as well have been. Every muscle was relaxed, and his breathing was slow and even. His eyes were closed because the barn was dark and there was nothing to see, but his mind was wide awake. Not racing, but just powering steadily along with that special nighttime intensity you get in the absence of any other distractions. He was doing two things at once. First, he was keeping track of time. It was nearly 2 hours since he had last looked at his watch, but he knew what time it was to within about 20 seconds. It was an old skill, born of many long, wakeful nights on active service. When you're waiting for something to happen, you close your body down like a beach house in winter, and you let your mind lock onto the steady pace of the passing seconds. It's like suspended animation. It saves energy, and it lifts the responsibility for your heartbeat away from your unconscious brain and passes it on to some kind of a hidden clock, makes a huge black space for thinking in. But it keeps you just awake enough to be ready for whatever you need to be ready for, and it means you always know what time it is. The second simultaneous thing Reacher was doing was playing around with a little mental arithmetic. He was multiplying big numbers in his head. He was 37 years and 8 months old, just about to the day. 37 multiplied by 365 was 13,505, plus 12 days for 12 leap years was 13,517. 8 months, counting from his birthday in October forward to this date in June, was 243 days, total of 13,760 days since he was born. 13,760 days, 13,760 nights. He was trying to place this particular night somewhere on that endless scale, in terms of how bad it was. Truth was, it wasn't the best night he had ever passed, but it was a long way from being the worst. A very long way. The first 4 or so years of his life, he couldn't remember anything at all, which left about 12,300 nights to account for. Probability was, this particular night was up there in the top third. Without even trying hard, he could have reeled off thousands of nights worse than this one. Tonight, he was warm, comfortable, uninjured, not under any immediate threat, and he'd been fed. Not well, but he felt that came from a lack of skill rather than from active malice. So physically, he had no complaints. Mentally, it was a different story. He was suspended in a vacuum just as impenetrable as the darkness inside the cow barn. The problem was the total lack of information. He was not a guy who necessarily felt uncomfortable with some lack of information. He was the son of a Marine officer and had lived the military life literally all the way since birth. Therefore, confusion and unpredictability were what he was accustomed to. But tonight there was just too much missing. He didn't know where he was. Whether by design or accident, the three kidnappers had given him absolutely no clue at all where they were headed. It made him feel adrift. His particular problem was living the military life from birth. Out of those 13,760 days of his life, he'd spent probably much less than a fifth of them actually inside the United States. He was as American as the president, but he'd lived and served all over the world most of his life, outside the United States. It had left him knowing his own country about as well as the average 7-year-old knows it, so he couldn't decode the subtle rhythms and feel and smells of America as well as he wanted to. It was possible that somebody else could interpret the unseen contours of the invisible landscape, or the feel of the air, or the temperature of the night, and say, "Yes, I'm in this state now," or "that state now." It was possible people could do that, but Reacher couldn't. It gave him a problem. Added to that, he had no idea who the kidnappers were, or what their business was, or what their intentions were. He'd studied them closely, every opportunity he'd had. Conclusions were difficult. The evidence was all contradictory. Three of them, youngish, maybe somewhere between 30 and 35, fit, trained to act together with a measure of efficiency. They were almost military, but not quite. They were organized, but not official. Their appearance shrieked, amateurs. Because they were so neat. They all had new clothes, plain chain store cottons and poplins, fresh haircuts. Their weapons were fresh out of the box. The Glocks were brand new. The shotgun was brand new, packing grease still visible. Those factors meant they weren't any kind of professionals, because professionals do this stuff every day. Whoever they are, special forces, CIA, FBI, detectives, it's their job. They wear working clothes. They use weapons they signed out last year, the year before. Tried and trusted weapons, chipped weapons, scratched weapons, working tools. Put three professionals together on any one day, and you'll see last night's pizza on one guy's shirt. Another guy won't have shaved. The third guy will be wearing the awful old pants his buddies make jokes about behind his back. It's possible you'll see a new jacket once in a while, or a fresh gun, or new shoes. But the chances of seeing everything new all at once on three working professionals on the same day are so slim as to be absurd. And their attitude betrayed them. Competent, but jumpy. Uptight, hostile, rude, tense. Trained to some degree, but not practiced. Not experienced. They'd rehearsed the theory, and they were smart enough to avoid any gross errors, but they didn't have the habituation of professionals. Therefore, these three were some kind of amateurs, and they had kidnapped a brand new FBI agent. Why? What the hell could a brand new FBI agent have done to anybody? Reacher had no idea. And the brand new FBI agent in question wasn't saying. Just another component he couldn't begin to figure. But not the biggest component. The biggest component he couldn't begin to figure was why the hell he was still there. He had no problem with how he had gotten grabbed up in the first place. Just a freak of chance had put him alongside Holly Johnson at the exact time the snatch was going down. He was comfortable with that. He understood freak chances. Life was built out of freak chances, however much people would like to pretend otherwise. And he never wasted time speculating about how things might have been different if this and if that. Obviously, if he'd been strolling on that particular Chicago street a minute earlier or a minute later, he'd have been right past that dry cleaner and never known a damn thing about all this. But he hadn't been strolling a minute earlier or a minute later, and the freak chance had happened, and he wasn't about to waste his time wondering where he would be now if it hadn't. But what he did need to pin down was why he was still there, just over 14 hours later, according to the clock inside his head. He'd had two marginal chances and one cast-iron certainty of getting out. Right away, on the street, he could have made it. Probably. The possibility of collateral damage had stopped him. Then in the abandoned lot, getting into the white truck, he might have made it. Probably. Three against one, both times, but they were three amateurs against Jack Reacher, and he felt comfortable enough about those odds. The cast-iron certainty was he could have been out of the cow barn, say, an hour after the three guys returned from the gas station with the truck. He could have slipped the cuff again, climbed the wall and dropped down into the barnyard and been away, just jogged over to the road and walked away and disappeared. Why hadn't he done that? He lay there in the huge, inky blackness of relaxation and realized it was Holly that was keeping him there. He hadn't bailed out because he couldn't take the risk. The three guys could have panicked and wasted her and run. Reacher didn't want that to happen. Holly was a smart, spirited woman, sharp, impatient, confident, tough as hell. Attractive, in a shy, unforced sort of a way. Dark, slim, a lot of intelligence and energy. Great eyes. Eyes were Reacher's thing. He was lost in a pair of pretty eyes. But it wasn't her eyes that were doing it to him. Not her looks, or her intelligence, or her personality. It was her knee. That's what was doing it to him. Her guts and her dignity. The sight of a good-looking, spirited woman cheerfully fighting an unaccustomed disability seemed like a brave and noble thing to Reacher. It made her his type of person. She was coping with it. She was doing it well. She wasn't complaining. She wasn't asking for his help. And because she wasn't asking for it, she was going to get it. 10. 5:30 Tuesday morning, FBI Special Agent Brogan was alone in the third-floor meeting room, using one of the newly installed phone lines for an early call to his girlfriend. 5:30 in the morning is not the best time to deliver an apology for a broken date from the night before, but Brogan had been very busy, and he anticipated being busier still, so he made the call. He woke her and told her he had been tied up and probably would be for the rest of the week. She was sleepy and annoyed, and made him repeat it all twice. Then she chose to interpret the message as a cowardly prelude to some kind of a brush-off. Brogan got annoyed in turn. He told her the Bureau had to come first. Surely she understood that. It was not the best point to be making to a sleepy, annoyed woman at 5:30 in the morning. They had a short row, and Brogan hung up, depressed. His partner, Milosevic, was alone in his own office cubicle, slumped in his chair, also depressed. His problem was a lack of imagination. It was his biggest weakness. McGrath had told him to trace Holly Johnson's every move from noon yesterday, but he hadn't come up with anything. He had seen her leaving the FBI building, stepping out of the door, onto the street, forearm jammed into the curved metal clip of her hospital cane. He had seen her getting that far, but then the picture just went blank. He thought hard all night and told McGrath nothing. 5:40, he went to the bathroom and got more coffee. Still miserable. He walked back to his desk, sat down, lost in thought for a long time. Then he glanced at the heavy gold watch on his wrist, checked the time, smiled, felt better, thought some more, checked his watch again. He nodded to himself. Now he could tell McGrath where Holly Johnson had gone at 12 o'clock yesterday. 1,702 miles away, panic had set in. Numb shock had carried the carpenter through the first hours. It had made him weak and acquiescent. He had let the employer hustle him up the stairs and into the room. Then numb shock had made him waste his first hours just sitting and staring. Then he had started up with a crazy optimism that this whole thing was some kind of a bad Halloween joke. That made him waste his next hours convinced nothing was going to happen. But then, like prisoners everywhere locked up alone in the cold, small hours of the night, all his defenses had stripped away and left him shaking and desperate with panic. With half his time gone, he burst into frantic action. But he knew it was hopeless. The irony was crushing him. They had worked hard on this room. They had built it right. Dollar signs had danced in front of their eyes. They had cut no corners. They had left out all their usual shoddy carpenter's tricks. Every single board was straight and tight. Every single nail was punched way down below the grain. There were no windows. The door was solid. It was hopeless. He spent an hour running around the room like a madman. He ran his rough palms over every square inch of every surface. Floor, ceiling, walls. It was the best job they had ever done. He ended up crouched in a corner, staring at his hands, crying.
"The dry cleaners," McGrath said. "That's where she went."
He was in the third floor conference room, head of the table, 7 o'clock Tuesday morning, opening a fresh pack of cigarettes.
"She did?" Brogan said. "The dry cleaners?"
McGrath nodded.
"Tell him, Milo," he said.
Milosevic smiled.
"I just remembered," he said. I've worked with her 5 weeks, right? Since she busted up her knee? Every Monday, lunchtime, she takes in her cleaning. Picks up last week's stuff. No reason for it to be any different yesterday.
Okay, Brogan said. Which cleaners?
Milosevic shook his head. Don't know, he said. She always went on her own. I always offered to do it for her, but she said no every time, 5 straight Mondays. Okay if I helped her out on bureau business, but she wasn't about to have me running around after her cleaning. She's a very independent type of a woman.
But she walked there, right?
McGrath said.
Right, Milosevic said. She always walked, with maybe 8 or 9 things on hangers, so we're safe to conclude the place she used is fairly near here.
Brogan nodded, smiled. They had some kind of a lead. He pulled the yellow pages over and opened it up to D.
What sort of a radius are we giving it? He said.
McGrath shrugged.
20 minutes there, 20 minutes back, he said. That would be about the max, right? With that crutch, I can't see her doing more than a quarter mile in 20 minutes. Limping like that? Call it a square, 1/2 mile on a side. This building is in the center. What does that give us?
Brogan used the AAA street map. He made a crude compass with his thumb and forefinger, adjusted it to 1/2 mile according to the scale in the margin, drew a square across the thicket of streets. Then he flipped back and forth between the map and the yellow pages, ticked off names with his pencil, counted them up.
At 21 establishments, he said.
McGrath stared at him.
21, he said. Are you sure?
Brogan nodded. Slid the phone book across the shiny hardwood.
21, he said. Obviously, people in this town like to keep their clothes real clean.
Okay, McGrath said. 21 places. Hit the road, guys.
Brogan took 10 addresses, and Milosevic took 11. McGrath issued them both with large color blow-ups of Holly Johnson's file photograph. Then he nodded them out and waited in his chair at the head of the conference room table next to the telephones, slumped, staring into space, smoking, drumming a worried little rhythm with the blunt end of his pencil. He heard faint sounds much earlier than he thought he should. He had no watch and no windows, but he was certain it was not yet morning. He was certain he had another hour, maybe two, but he could hear noise, people moving in the street outside. He held his breath and listened. Maybe 3 or 4 people. He quartered the room again, frozen with indecision. He should be pounding and kicking at the new pine boards. He knew that, but he wasn't, because he knew it was hopeless, and because he felt in his gut he must be silent. He had become sure of that, convinced. If he was silent, they might leave him alone. They might forget he was in there. Milosevic found the right place. The 7th of the 11 establishments on his list. It was just opening up for business, 7:40 in the morning. Just a storefront place, but elegant, not really aimed at the typical commuter's cheap worsteds. It advertised all kinds of specialized processes and custom treatments. There was a Korean woman in charge of the store. Milosevic showed her his FBI shield and placed Holly's file picture flat on the counter in front of her. "You ever see this person?" he asked her. The Korean woman looked at the picture, politely, with concentration, her hands clasped together behind her back.
"Sure," she said. "That Miss Johnson comes in every Monday."
Milosevic stepped closer to the counter. He leaned up close to the woman. "She come in yesterday?" Milosevic asked her. The woman thought about it and nodded.
"Sure," she said. "Like I told you, she come in every Monday."
"What kind of time?" he asked.
"Lunch hour?"
the woman said.
"Or with lunch hour?"
"About 12, he said. 12:30, something like that.
"Sure,"
the woman said.
"Always lunch hour on a Monday."
"Okay, yesterday," Milosevic said. "What happened?" The woman shrugged.
"Nothing happened," she said. "She came in, she took her garment, she paid, she left some garment to be cleaned."
"Anybody with her?" he asked.
"Nobody with her," the woman said. "Nobody ever with her."
"Which direction was she headed?" Milosevic asked. The woman pointed back toward the federal building.
"She came from that direction," she said.
"I didn't ask you where she came from," Milosevic said. "Where did she head when she left?"
The woman paused.
I didn't see, she said. I took her garments through to the back. I heard the door open, but I couldn't see where she went. I went in back.
You just grabbed her stuff, Milosevic said. Rushed through to the back before she was out of here?
The woman faltered like she was being accused of an impoliteness.
Not rushed, she said. Miss Johnson was walking slow, bad leg, right? I felt I shouldn't stare at her. I felt she was embarrassed. I walked her clothes through to the back so she wouldn't feel I was watching her.
Milosevic nodded and tilted his head back and sighed up at the ceiling. Saw a video camera mounted high above the counter.
What's that? He said.
The Korean woman twisted and followed his gaze.
Security, she said. Insurance companies say we got to have it.
Does it work? He asked.
Sure it works, the woman said. Insurance companies say he's got to.
Does it run all the time? Milosevic asked.
The woman nodded and giggled.
Sure it does, she said. It's running right now. You'll be on the tape.
Milosevic checked his watch.
I need yesterday's tape, he said. Immediately.
The woman faltered again. Milosevic pulled his shield for the second time.
This is an FBI investigation, he said. Official federal business. I need that tape right now, okay?
The woman nodded and held up her hand to make him wait, stepped through a door to the rear of the establishment, came back out after a long moment with a blast of chemical smell and a video cassette in her hand.
You let me have it back, okay? She said. Insurance company says we got to keep them for a month.
Milosevic took it straight in, and by 8:30, the bureau technicians were swarming all over the third-floor conference room again, hooking up a standard VHS player to the bank of monitors piled down the middle of the long table. There was a problem with the fuse, and then the right wire proved too short, so a computer had to be moved to allow the video player to get nearer to the center of the table. Then the head tech handed McGrath the remote and nodded.
All yours, Chief, he said.
McGrath sent him out of the room, and the three agents crowded around the screens, waiting for the picture to roll. The screens faced the wall of windows, so they all three had their backs to the glass. But at that time of day, there was no danger of anybody getting uncomfortable, because right then the bright morning sun was blasting the other side of the building. That same sun rolled on 1,702 miles from Chicago, and made it bright morning outside the white building. He knew it had come. He could hear the quiet ticking as the old wood frame warmed through. He could hear muffled voices outside, below him, down at street level, the sound of people starting a new day. His fingernails were gone. He had found a gap where two boards were not hard together. He had forced his fingertips down and levered with all his strength. His nails had torn off, one after the other. The board had not moved. He had scuttled backward into a corner and curled up on the floor. He had sucked his bloodied fingers, and now his mouth was smeared all around with blood, like a child's with cake. He heard footsteps on the staircase, a big man moving lightly. The sound halted outside the door. The lock clicked back. The door opened. The employer looked in at him. Bloated face, two nickel-sized red spots burning high on his cheeks.
"You're still here," he said.
The carpenter was paralyzed, couldn't move, couldn't speak.
"You failed,"
the employer said. There was silence in the room. The only sound was the slow ticking of the wood frame as the morning sun slid over the roof.
"So what shall we do now?"
the employer asked. The carpenter just stared blankly at him. Didn't move. Then the employer smiled a relaxed, friendly smile, like he was suddenly surprised about something.
"You think I meant it?"
he said, gently. The carpenter blinked, shook his head slightly, hopefully.
"You hear anything?"
the employer asked him. The carpenter listened hard. He could hear the quiet ticking of the wood, the song of the forest birds, the silent sound of sunny morning air.
"You were just kidding around?"
he asked. His voice was a dry croak. Relief and hope and dread were jamming his tongue into the roof of his mouth.
"Listen,"
the employer said. The carpenter listened. The frame ticked. The bird sang. The warm air sighed. He heard nothing else. Silence. Then he heard a click. Then he heard a whine. It started, slow and quiet, and stabilized up at a familiar, loud pitch. It was a sound he knew. It was the sound of a big power saw being run up to speed.
"Now do you think I meant it?"
the employer screamed. 11. Holly Johnson had been mildly disappointed by Reacher's assessment of the cash value of her wardrobe. Reacher had said he figured she had maybe 15 or 20 outfits, $400 an outfit, maybe $8,000 in total. Truth was, she had 34 business suits in her closet. She'd worked 3 years on Wall Street. She had $8,000 tied up in the shoes alone. $400 was what she had spent on a blouse, and that was when she felt driven by native common sense to be a little economical. She liked Armani. She had 13 of his spring suits. Spring clothes from Milan were just about right for most of the Chicago summer. Maybe in the really fierce heat of August she'd break out her Moschino shifts, but June and July, September too, if she was lucky, her Armanis were the thing. Her favorites were the dark peach shades she'd bought in her last year in the brokerage house, some mysterious Italian blend of silks, cut and tailored by people whose ancestors have been fingering fine materials for hundreds of years. They look at it and consider it and cut it, and it just falls into marvelous soft shapes. Then they market it, and a Wall Street broker buys it and loves it and is still wearing it 2 years into the future when she's a new FBI agent and she gets snatched off a Chicago street. She's still wearing it 18 hours later, after a sleepless night on the filthy straw in a cow barn. By that point, the thing is no longer something that Armani would recognize. The three kidnappers had returned with the truck and backed it into the cow barn's central concrete aisle. Then they had locked the barn door and disappeared. Holly guessed they had spent the night in the farmhouse. Reacher had slept quietly in his stall, chained to the railing while she tossed and turned in the straw, sleepless, thinking urgently about him. His safety was her responsibility. He was an innocent passerby caught up in her business. Whatever else lay ahead for her, she had to take care of him. That was her duty. He was her burden. And he was lying. Holly was absolutely certain he was not a Blues Club doorman, and she was pretty certain what he was. The Johnson family was a military family. Because of her father, Holly had lived on Army bases her whole life, right up to Yale. She knew the Army. She knew soldiers. She knew the types, and she knew Reacher was one. To her practiced eye, he looked like one, acted like one, reacted like one. It was possible a doorman could pick locks and climb walls like an ape, but if a doorman did go ahead and do that, he would do it with an air of unfamiliarity and daring and breathlessness which would be quite distinctive. He wouldn't do it like it came as naturally as blinking. Reacher was a quiet, contained man, relaxed, fit, clearly trained to the point of some kind of superhuman calm. He was probably 10 years older than she was, but somewhere less than 40, about 6'5", huge, maybe 220, blue eyes, thinning fair hair, big enough to be a doorman and old enough to have been around, that was for sure. But he was a soldier. A soldier claiming to be a doorman. But why? Holly had no idea. She just lay there, uncomfortable, listening to his quiet breathing 20 feet away. Doorman or soldier, 10 years older or not, it was her responsibility to get him to safety. She didn't sleep. Too busy thinking, and her knee was too painful. At 8:30 on her watch, she heard him wake up, just a subtle change in the rhythm of his breathing.
"Good morning, Reacher,"
she called out.
"Morning, Holly," he said. "They're coming back."
He was silent, but after a long moment, she heard footsteps outside. "Climbs like an ape, hears like a bat," she thought. "Some doorman."
"You okay?"
Reacher called to her. She didn't answer.
His welfare was her responsibility, not the other way around. She heard a rattle as the barn door was unlocked. It rolled open and daylight flooded in. She caught a glimpse of empty green country. Pennsylvania. Maybe, she thought. The three kidnappers walked in and the door was pulled shut.
Get up, bitch, the leader said to her.
She didn't move. She was seized by an overpowering desire not to be put back inside the truck. Too dark, too uncomfortable, too tedious. She didn't know if she could take another day in there, swaying, jolting, above all, totally unaware of where the hell she was being taken, or why, or by who. Instinctively, she grabbed the metal railing and held on, arm tensed, like she was going to put up a struggle. The leader stood still and pulled out his Glock, looked down at her.
Two ways of doing this, he said. The easy way or the hard way?
She didn't reply, just sat there in the straw and held on tight to the railing. The ugly driver took three steps nearer and started smiling, staring at her breasts again. She felt naked and revolted under his gaze.
Your choice, bitch, the leader said.
She heard Reacher moving in his stall.
No, it's your choice, she heard him call to the guy. We need to be a little mutual here. Cooperative, right? You want us to get back in your truck, you need to make it worth our while.
His voice was calm and low. Holly stared across at him, saw him sitting there, chained up, unarmed, facing a loaded automatic weapon, totally powerless by any reasonable definition of the word. Three hostile men staring down at him.
We need some breakfast, Reacher said. Toast with grape jelly and coffee, but make it a lot stronger than last night's crap, okay?
Good coffee is very important to me. You need to understand that. Then put a couple of mattresses in the truck, one queen size, one twin. Make us a sofa in there. Then we'll get in. There was total silence. Holly glanced between the two men. Reacher was fixing the leader with a calm, level gaze from the floor. His blue eyes never blinked. The leader was staring down at him, tension visible in the air. The driver had torn his gaze away from her body and was looking at Reacher, anger in his eyes. Then the leader snapped around and nodded the other two out of the barn with him. Holly heard the door locking behind them.
You eat toast? Reacher said to her.
She was too breathless to answer.
When they bring it, send it back, he said. Make them do it over. Say it's too pale or too burnt or something.
What the hell do you think you're doing? She asked.
Psychology, Reacher said. We need to start getting some dominance here. Situation like this, it's very important.
She stared at him.
Just do it, okay? He said calmly.
She did it. The jumpy guy brought the toast. It was just about perfect, but she rejected it. She looked at it with the disdain she'd use on a sloppy balance sheet and said it was too well done. She was standing with all her weight on one foot, looking like a mess, dung all over her peach Armani, but she managed enough haughty contempt to intimidate the guy. He went back to the farmhouse kitchen and made more. It came with a pot of strong coffee, and Holly and Reacher ate their separate breakfasts, chains clanking 20 feet apart, while the other two guys hauled mattresses into the barn. One queen, one twin. They pulled them up into the back of the truck and laid the queen out on the floor and stood the twin at right angles to it, up against the back of the cab bulkhead. Holly watched them do it and felt a whole lot better about the day. Then she suddenly realized exactly where Reacher's psychology had been aimed. Not just at the three kidnappers, at her too. He didn't want her to get into a fight, because she'd lose. He'd risked doing what he'd done to defuse a hopeless confrontation. She was amazed, totally amazed. She thought blankly, for Christ's sake, this guy's got it ass backward. He's trying to take care of me.
You want to tell us your names? Reacher asked calmly. We're spending some time together. We can be a little civilized about it, right?
Holly saw the leader just looking at him. The guy made no reply.
We've seen your faces, Reacher said. Telling us your names isn't going to do you any harm, and we might as well try to get along.
The guy thought about it and nodded.
Loader, he said.
The little jumpy guy shifted feet.
Stevie,
he said. Reacher nodded. Then the ugly driver realized all four were looking at him. He ducked his head.
I'm not telling you my name, he said.
Hell, should I?
And let's be real clear,
the guy called Loader said.
Civilized is not the same thing as friendly.
Right? Holly saw him aim his Glock at Reacher's head and hold it there for a long moment. Nothing in his face. Not the same thing as friendly. Reacher nodded, a small, cautious movement. They left their toast plates and their coffee mugs lying on the straw, and the guy called Loader unlocked their chains. They met in the central aisle, two Glocks and a shotgun aimed at them, the ugly driver leering. Reacher looked him in the eye and ducked down and picked Holly up like she weighed nothing at all, carried her the 10 paces to the truck, put her down gently inside. They crawled forward together to the improvised sofa, got themselves comfortable. The truck's rear doors slammed and locked. Holly heard the big barn door open up. The truck's engine turned over and caught. They drove out of the barn and bounced 150 yards over the rough track, turned an invisible right angle, and cruised straight and slow down a road for 15 minutes.
"We aren't in Pennsylvania," Holly said. "Roads are too straight. Too flat."
Reacher just shrugged at her in the dark.
"We aren't in handcuffs anymore either," he said.
Psychology.
12.
"Hell is this?"
Agent in charge McGrath said. He thumbed the remote and rewound the tape. Then he pressed play and watched it again. But what he saw meant nothing at all. The video screens were filled with jerky, speeding images and shashy white snow.
"Hell is going on here?"
he asked again. Brogan crowded in and shook his head. Milosevic pushed closer to look. He'd brought the tape in, so he felt personally responsible for it. McGrath hit rewind again and tried once more. Same result, just a blur of disjointed flashing pictures.
"Get the damn tech guy back in here,"
he shouted. Milosevic used the phone on a credenza next to the coffee pot, called upstairs to tech services. The head tech was in the room within a minute. The tone of Milosevic's voice had told him to hurry more effectively than any words could have.
"Damn tape won't run properly," McGrath told him.
The technician took the remote in his hand with that blend of familiarity and unfamiliarity that tech guys use the world over. They're all at home with complex equipment, but each individual piece has its own peculiarities. He peered at the buttons and pressed rewind, firmly, with a chewed thumb. The tape whirred back, and he pressed play and watched the disjointed stream of flashing images and video snow.
"You fix that?"
McGrath asked him. The tech stopped the tape and hit rewind again, shook his head.
"It's not broken," he said. "That's how it's supposed to be. Typical cheap surveillance video. What it does is record a freeze frame, probably every 10 seconds or so. Just one frame every 10 seconds, like a sequence of snapshots."
"Why?"
McGrath asked him.
"Cheap and easy," the guy said. "You can get a whole day on one tape that way. Low cost, and you don't have to remember to change the cassette every 3 hours. You just change it in the morning. And assuming a stick-up takes longer than 10 seconds to complete, you've got the perp's face right there on tape, at least once."
"Okay,"
McGrath said impatiently.
"So how do we use it?"
The tech used two fingers together, pressed play and freeze at the same time. Up on the screen came a perfect black and white still picture of an empty store. In the bottom left corner was Monday's date and the time, 7:35 in the morning. The tech held the remote out to McGrath and pointed to a small button.
"See this?"
he said.
"Frame advance button. Press this and the tape rolls onto the next still. Usually for sports, right? Hockey, you can see the puck go right in the net. Or for porn, you can see whatever you need to see. But on this type of a system, it jumps you ahead 10 seconds, like onto the next snapshot, right?"
McGrath calmed down and nodded.
"Why is it in black and white?"
he said.
"Cheap camera," the tech guy said. "The whole thing is a cheap system. They only put them in because the insurance companies tell them they got to."
He handed the remote to McGrath and headed back for the door.
"You want anything else, you let me know, okay?"
he called. He got no reply because everybody was staring at the screen as McGrath started inching his way through the tape. Every time he hit the frame advance button, a broad band of white snow scrolled down the screen and unveiled a new picture. Same aspect, same angle, same dim monochrome gray, but with the time code at the bottom jumped ahead 10 seconds. The third frame showed a woman behind the counter. Milosevic touched the screen with his finger.
"That's the woman I spoke to," he said.
McGrath nodded.
"Wide field of view," he said. "You can see all the way from behind the counter right out into the street."
"Wide-angle lens on the camera," Brogan said. "Like a fisheye sort of thing. The owner can see everything. He can see the customers coming in and out, and he can see if the help is fiddling the register."
McGrath nodded again and trolled through Monday morning 10 seconds at a time. Customers jumped in and out of shot. The woman behind the counter jumped from side to side, fetching and carrying and ringing up the payments. Outside, cars flashed in and out of view.
"Fast forward to 12 o'clock, Milosevic said. "This is taking way too long."
McGrath nodded and fiddled with the remote. The tape whirred forward. He pressed stop and play and freeze and came up with 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
"Shit,"
he said. He wound back and forward a couple of times and came up with 11:43 and 50 seconds.
"Close as we're going to get," he said.
He kept his finger hard on the frame advance button, and the white snow scrolled continuously down the screen. 157 frames later, he stopped.
"There she is," he said.
Milosevic and Brogan shouldered together for a closer look. The still frame showed Holly Johnson on the far right of the picture. She was outside, on the sidewalk, crutch in one hand, clothes on hangers in the other. She was hauling the door open with a spare finger. The time in the bottom left of the frame was stopped at 10 minutes and 10 seconds past 12 noon.
"Okay," McGrath said quietly. "So let's see."
He hit the button, and Holly jumped halfway over to the counter. Even frozen on the misty monochrome screen, her awkward posture was plain to see. McGrath hit the button again, and the snow rolled over, and Holly was at the counter. 10 seconds later, the Korean woman was there with her. 10 seconds after that, Holly had folded back a hem on one of her suits and was showing the woman something, probably the position of a particular stain. The two women stayed like that for a couple of minutes, heads together for 12 frames, jumping slightly from one shot to the next. Then the Korean woman was gone, and the clothes were off the counter, and Holly was standing alone for 5 frames. 50 seconds. Behind her, on the left, a car nosed into shot on the second frame and stayed there for the next 3, parked at the curb. Then the woman was back with an armful of clean clothes and bags. She was frozen in the act of laying them flat on the counter. 10 seconds later, she had torn 5 tags off the hangers. 10 seconds after that, she had another 4 lined up next to the register.
9 outfits, McGrath said.
"That's about right," Milosevic said. 5 for work, Monday to Friday, and I guess 4 for evening wear, right?
"What about the weekend?" Brogan said. "Maybe it's 5 for work, 2 for evening wear, and 2 at the weekend?"
"Probably wears jeans at the weekend," Milosevic said. "Jeans and a shirt. Just throws them in the machine, maybe?"
"God's sake, does it matter?" McGrath said.
He pressed the button, and the Korean woman's fingers were caught dancing over the register's keys. The next 2 stills showed Holly paying in cash and accepting a couple of dollars change.
"How much is all that costing her?"
Brogan asked out loud.
9 garments, Milosevic said. "Best part of $50 a week, that's for damn sure. I saw the price list in there, specialized processes and gentle chemicals and all."
The next frame showed Holly starting toward the exit door on the left of the picture. The top of the Korean woman's head was visible on her way through to the back of the store. The time was showing at 12:15, exactly. McGrath hitched his chair closer and stuck his face a foot from the glowing monochrome screen.
"Okay," he said. "So where did you go now, Holly?"
She had the 9 cleaned garments in her left hand. She was holding them up awkwardly so they wouldn't drag on the floor. Her right elbow was jammed into the curved metal clip of her crutch, but her hand wasn't gripping the handle. The next frame showed it reaching out to push the door open. McGrath hit the button again.
Christ!
He shouted. Milosevic gasped out loud, and Brogan looked stunned. There was no doubt about what they were seeing. The next frame showed an unknown man attacking Holly Johnson. He was tall and heavy. He was seizing her crutch with one hand and her cleaning with the other, no doubt about it. Both his arms were extended, and he was taking her crutch and her cleaning away from her. He was caught in a perfect snapshot through the glass door. The three agents stared at him. There was total silence in the conference room. Then McGrath hit the button again. The time code jumped ahead 10 seconds. There was another gasp as they caught their breath simultaneously. Holly Johnson was suddenly surrounded by a triangle of three men. The tall guy who had attacked her had been joined by two more. The tall guy had Holly's cleaning slung up over his shoulder, and he had seized Holly's arm. He was staring straight up into the store window like he knew a camera was in there. The other two guys were facing Holly head on.
"They pulled guns on her!" McGrath shouted. "Son of a bitch, look at that!"
He thumbed the button again until the bar of snow cleared away from the bottom of the frame and the whole picture stabilized into perfect sharpness. The two new guys had their right arms bent at 90 degrees, and there was tension showing in their shoulder muscles.
"The car," Milosevic said. "They're going to put her in the car."
Beyond Holly and the triangle of men was the car which had parked up 14 frames ago. It was just sitting there at the curb. McGrath hit the button again. The bar of white snow scrolled down. The small knot of people on the screen jumped sideways 10 feet. The tall guy who had attacked Holly was leading the way into the back of the car. Holly was being pushed in after him by one of the new guys. The other new guy was opening the front passenger door. Inside the car, a fourth man was plainly visible through the side glass, sitting at the wheel. McGrath hit the button again. The bar of snow scrolled down. The street was empty. The car was gone, like it had never been there at all. 13.
"We need to talk," Holly said.
"So, talk," Reacher replied. They were sprawled out on the mattresses in the gloom inside the truck, rocking and bouncing, but not much. It was pretty clear they were heading down a highway. After 15 minutes of a slow, straight road, there had been a deceleration, a momentary stop, and a left turn, followed by steady acceleration up a ramp, then a slight sway as the truck nudged left onto the pavement, then a steady, droning cruise, maybe 60 miles an hour, which had continued ever since and was feeling like it would continue forever. The temperature inside the dark space had slowly climbed higher. Now it was pretty warm. Reacher had taken his shirt off. But the truck had started cool from the night in the cow barn, and Reacher felt as long as it kept moving through the air, it was going to be tolerable. The problem would come if they stopped for any length of time. Then the truck would heat up like a pizza oven, and it would get as bad as it had gotten the day before. The twin-sized mattress had been standing upright on its long edge, up against the forward bulkhead, and the queen size had been flat on the floor, jammed up against it, making a crude sofa. But the 90-degree angle between the seat and the back had made the whole thing uncomfortable. So Reacher had slid the queen size backward, with Holly riding on it like a sled, and laid the twin flat next to it. Now they had an 8-foot by 6'6" flat padded area. They were lying down on their backs, heads together so they could talk, bodies apart in a decorous V-shape, rocking gently with the motion of the ride.
"You should do what I tell you," Holly said. "You should have gotten out."
He made no reply.
"You're a burden to me," she said. "You understand that? I've got enough on my hands here without having to worry about you."
He didn't reply. They lay rocking in silence. He could smell yesterday morning's shampoo in her hair.
"So you've got to do what I tell you from now on," she said. "Are you listening to me? I just can't afford to be worrying about you."
He turned his head to look at her close up.
She was worrying about him.
It came as a big surprise, out of nowhere, a shock, like being on a train, stopped next to another train in a busy railroad station. Your train begins to move. It picks up speed. And then, all of a sudden, it's not your train moving. It's the other train. Your train was stationary all the time. Your frame of reference was wrong. He thought his train was moving. She thought hers was.
"I don't need your help," she said. "I've already got all the help I need. You know how the Bureau works? You know what the biggest crime in the world is? Not bombing, not terrorism, not racketeering. The biggest crime in the world is messing with Bureau personnel. The Bureau looks after its own.
Reacher stayed quiet for a spell. Then he smiled. So then we're both okay, he said. We just lay back here, and pretty soon a bunch of agents is going to come bursting in to rescue us.
I trust my people,
Holly said to him. There was silence again. The truck droned on for a couple of minutes. Reacher ticked off the distance in his head. About 450 miles from Chicago, maybe. East, west, north, or south. Holly gasped and used both hands to shift her leg. Hurting? Reacher said.
When it gets out of line, she said. When it's straight, it's okay.
Which direction are we headed? He asked.
Are you going to do what I tell you? She asked.
Is it getting hotter or colder? He said. Or staying the same? She shrugged.
Can't tell, she said. Why?
North or south, it should be getting hotter or colder, he said. East or west, it should be staying more or less the same.
Feels the same to me, she said. But inside here, you can't really tell.
Highway feels fairly empty, Reacher said. We're not pulling out to pass people. We're not getting slowed down by anybody. We're just cruising.
So?
Holly said. Might mean we're not going east, he said. There's a kind of barrier, right? Cleveland to Pittsburgh to Baltimore, like a frontier. Gets much busier. We'd be hitting more traffic. What is it, Tuesday? About 11 o'clock in the morning? Road feels too empty for the east. Holly nodded.
So we're going north or west or south, she said.
In a stolen truck, he said. Vulnerable.
Stolen, she said. How do you know that?
Because the car was stolen, too, he said.
How do you know that? She repeated.
Because they burned it, he said. Holly rolled her head and looked straight at him. Think about it, he said. Think about their plan. They came to Chicago in their own vehicle, maybe some time ago. Could have taken them a couple of weeks to stake you out, maybe three.
3 weeks, she said. You think they were watching me 3 weeks?
Probably three, he said. You went to the cleaners every Monday, right? Once a week? Must have taken them a while to confirm that pattern. But they couldn't grab you in their own vehicle. Too easy to trace, and it probably had windows and all, not suitable for long-distance transport of a kidnap victim. So I figure they stole this truck, in Chicago, probably yesterday morning, painted over whatever writing was on the side. You notice the patch of white paint? Fresh, didn't match the rest? They disguised it, maybe changed the plates. But it was still a hot truck, right? And it was their getaway vehicle. So they didn't want to risk it on the street. And people getting into the back of a truck looks weird. A car is better. So they stole the black sedan and used that instead. Switched vehicles on that vacant lot, burned the black car, and they're away. Holly shrugged, made a face.
Doesn't prove they stole anything, she said.
Yes, it does, Reacher said. Who buys a new car with leather seats knowing they're going to burn it? They'd have bought some old clunker instead. She nodded reluctantly.
Who are these people?
She said, more to herself than Reacher. Amateurs, Reacher said. They're making one mistake after another.
Like what?
She said. Burning is dumb, he said. Attracts attention. They think they've been smart, but they haven't. Probability is they burned their original car as well. I bet they burned it right near where they stole the black sedan.
Sounds smart enough to me, Holly said.
Cops notice burning cars, Reacher said. They'll find the black sedan. They'll find out where it was stolen from. They'll go up there and find the original vehicle, probably still smoldering. They're leaving a trail, Holly. They should have parked both cars in the long-term lot at O'Hare. They would have been there a year before anybody noticed. Or just left them both down on the south side somewhere. Doors open, keys in. 2 minutes later, two residents down there got themselves a new motor each. Those cars would never have been seen again. That's how to cover your tracks. Burning feels good, feels like it's real final, but it's dumb as hell. Holly turned her face back and stared up at the hot metal roof. She was asking herself, just who the hell is this guy? 14. This time, McGrath did not make the tech chief come down to the third floor. He led the charge himself up to his lab on the sixth with the video cassette in his hand. He burst in through the door and cleared a space on the nearest table, laid the cassette in the space like it was made of solid gold. The guy hurried over and looked at it.
"I need photographs made," McGrath told him.
The guy picked up the cassette and took it across to a bank of video machines in the corner, flicked a couple of switches. Three screens lit up with white snow.
"You tell absolutely nobody what you're seeing, okay?"
McGrath said.
"Okay,"
the guy said.
What am I looking for?"
"The last five frames," McGrath said. "That should just about cover it."
The tech chief didn't use a remote. He stabbed at buttons on the machine's own control panel. The tape rolled backward, and the story of Holly Johnson's kidnap unfolded in reverse.
"Christ," he said.
He stopped on the frame showing Holly turning away from the counter. Then he inched the tape forward. He jumped Holly to the door, then face to face with the tall guy, then into the muzzles of the guns, then to the car. He rolled back and did it for a second time, then a third.
"Christ,"
he said again.
"Don't wear the damn tape out," McGrath said. "I want big photographs of those five frames, lots of copies."
The tech chief nodded slowly.
"I can give you laser prints right now," he said.
He punched a couple of buttons and flicked a couple of switches. Then he ducked away and booted up a computer on a desk across the room. The monitor came up with Holly leaving the dry cleaner's counter. He clicked on a couple of menus.
"Okay," he said. "I'm copying it to the hard disk as a graphics file."
He darted back to the video bank and nudged the tape forward one frame. Came back to the desk, and the computer captured the image of Holly making to push open the exit door. He repeated the process three more times. Then he printed all five graphics files on the fastest laser he had. McGrath stood and caught each sheet as it flopped into the output bin.
"Not bad," he said. "I like paper better than video, like it really exists."
The tech chief gave him a look and peered over his shoulder.
"Definition's okay," he said.
"I want blow-ups," McGrath told him.
"No problem. Now it's in the computer," the tech said. "That's why the computer is better than paper."
He sat down and opened the fourth file. The picture of Holly and the three kidnappers in a tight knot on the sidewalk scrolled onto the screen. He clicked the mouse and pulled a tight square around the heads. Clicked again. The monitor redrew into a large blow-up. The tall guy was staring straight out of the screen. The two new guys were caught at an angle, staring at Holly. The tech hit the print button, and then he opened the fifth file. He zoomed in with the mouse and put a tight rectangle around the driver, inside the car. He printed that out, too. McGrath picked up the new sheets of paper.
"Good," he said. "Good as we're gonna get, anyway. Shame your damn computer can't make them all look right at the camera."
"It can," the tech chief said.
"It can," McGrath said. "How?"
"In a manner of speaking," the guy said.
He touched the blow-up of Holly's face with his finger.
"Suppose we wanted a face-front picture of her, right? We'd ask her to move around right in front of the camera and look right up at it. But suppose, for some reason, she can't move at all. What would we do? We could move the camera, right? Suppose you climbed up on the counter and unbolted the camera off the wall and moved it down and around a certain distance until it was right in front of her. Then you'd be seeing a face-front picture, correct?"
"Okay," McGrath said.
"So what we do is we calculate," the tech said. "We calculate that if we did hypothetically move that camera right in front of her, we'd have to move it, what, say, 6 feet downward, say 10 feet to the left, and turn it through about 40 degrees, and then it would be plumb face on to her. So we get those numbers, and we enter them into the program, and the computer will do a kind of backward simulation and draw us a picture, just the same as if we'd really move the actual camera right around in front of her."
"You can do that?" McGrath said. "Does it work?"
"Within its limitations," the tech chief said.
He touched the image of the nearer gunman.
"This guy, for instance, he's pretty much side on. The computer will give us a full-face picture, no problem at all, but it's going to be just guessing what the other side of his face looks like, right? It's programmed to assume the other side looks pretty much like the side it can see, with a little bit of asymmetry built in. But if the guy's got one ear missing or something, or a big scar, he can't tell us that."
"Okay," McGrath said. "So what do you need?"
The chief tech picked up the wide shot of the group, pointed here and there on it with a stubby forefinger.
"Measurements," he said. "Make them as exact as possible. I need to know the camera position relative to the doorway and the sidewalk level. I need to know the focal length of the camera lens. I need Holly's file photograph for calibration. We know exactly what she looks like, right? I can use her for a test run. I'll get it set up so she comes out right, then the other guys will come out right as well, assuming they've all got two ears and so on, like I said. And bring me a square of tile off the store's floor and one of those smocks the counter woman was wearing.
What for? McGrath said.
So I can use them to decode the grays in the video, the tech said. Then I can give you your mugshots in color.
The commander selected six women from that morning's punishment detail. He used the ones with the most demerits, because the task was going to be hard and unpleasant. He stood them at attention and drew his huge bulk up to its full height in front of them. He waited to see which of them would be the first to glance away from his face. When he was satisfied none of them dared to, he explained their duties. The blood had sprayed all over the room, hurled around by the savage centrifugal force of the blade. Chips of bone had spattered everywhere. He told them to heat water in the cookhouse and carry it over in buckets. He told them to draw scrubbing brushes and rags and disinfectant from the stores. He told them they had 2 hours to get the room looking pristine again. Any longer than that, they would earn more demerits. It took 2 hours to get the data. Milosevic and Brogan went out to the dry cleaning establishment. They closed the place down and swarmed all over it like surveyors. They drew a plan with measurements accurate to the nearest quarter inch. They took the camera off the wall and brought it back with them. They tore up the floor and took the tiles. They took 2 smocks from the woman and 2 posters off the wall because they thought they might help with the colorizing process. Back on the 6th floor of the federal building, the chief tech took another 2 hours to input the data. Then he ran the test, using Holly Johnson to calibrate the program.
What do you think?
He asked McGrath. McGrath looked hard at the full-face picture of Holly. Then he passed it around. Milosevic got it last and stared at it hardest, covered some parts with his hand, and frowned.
Makes her look too thin, he said. I think the bottom right quarter is wrong. Not enough width there, somehow.
I agree, McGrath said. Makes her jaw look weird.
The chief tech exited to a menu screen and adjusted a couple of numbers. Ran the test again. The laser printer whirred. The sheet of stiff paper came out.
That's better, McGrath said. Just about on the nose.
Color okay?
The tech asked.
Should be a darker peach, Milosevic said. On her dress? I know that dress, some kind of an Italian thing.
The tech exited to a color palette.
Show me,
he said. Milosevic pointed to a particular shade.
More like that, he said.
They ran the test again. The hard disk chattered and the laser printer whirred.
That's better, Milosevic said. Dress is right. Hair color is better as well.
Okay,
the tech said. He saved all the parameters to disk.
Let's go to work here.
The FBI never uses latest generation equipment. The feeling is it's better to use stuff that has been proven in the field. So the tech chief's computer was actually a little slower than the computers in the rich kids' bedrooms up and down the North Shore. But not much slower. It gave McGrath 5 prints within 40 minutes. 4 mugshots of the 4 kidnappers and a close-up side view of the front half of their car. All in glowing color, all with the grain enhanced and smoothed away. McGrath thought they were the best damn pictures he had ever seen.
Thanks, chief, he said. These are brilliant. Best work anybody has done around here for a long time. But don't say a word. Big secret, right?
He clapped the tech on the shoulder and left him feeling like the most important guy in the whole building. The 6 women worked hard and finished just before their 2 hours were up. The tiny cracks between the boards were their biggest problem. The cracks were tight, but not tight enough to stop the blood seeping in. But they were too tight to get a brush down in there. They had to sluice them out with water and rag them dry. The boards were turning a wet brown color. The women were praying they wouldn't warp as they dried. 2 of them were throwing up. It was adding to their workload. But they finished in time for the commander's inspection. They stood rigidly to attention on the damp floor and waited. He checked everywhere, with the wet boards creaking under his bulk. but he was satisfied with their work and gave them another 2 hours to clean the smears off the corridor and the staircase where the body had been dragged away. The car was easy. It was quickly identified as a Lexus, 4-door, late model. The pattern of the alloy wheel dated it exactly. Color was either black or dark gray. Impossible to be certain. The computer process was good, but not good enough to be definitive about dark automotive paint standing in bright sunshine.
Stolen?
Milosevic said. McGrath nodded.
Almost certainly, he said. You do the checking, okay?
Fluctuations in the value of the yen had put the list price of a new Lexus 4-door somewhere up there with Milosevic's annual salary, so he knew which jurisdictions were worth checking with and which weren't. He didn't bother with anywhere south of the loop. He put in calls to the Chicago cops and then all the departments on the North Shore right up to Lake Forest. He got a hit just before noon. Not exactly what he was looking for. Not a stolen Lexus, but a missing Lexus. The police department in Wilmette came back to him and said a dentist up there had driven his brand new Lexus to work before 7 on Monday morning and parked it in the lot behind his professional building. A chiropractor from the next office suite had seen him turn into the lot, but the dentist had never made it into the building. His nurse had called his home, and his wife had called the Wilmette PD. The cops had taken the report and sat on it. It wasn't the first case of a husband disappearing they'd ever heard of. They told Milosevic the guy's name was Reuben, and the car was the new shade of black, mica flex in the paint to make it sparkle, and it had vanity plates reading Ortho 1. Milosevic put the phone down on that call, and it rang again straight away with a report from the Chicago Fire Department. A unit had attended an automobile fire which was putting up a cloud of oily smoke into the landside flight path into Miggs Field Airport. The fire truck had arrived in an abandoned industrial lot just before 1 o'clock Monday and found a black Lexus burning fiercely. They had figured it was burned to the metal anyway. Not much more smoke to come, so they had saved their foam and just left it to burn out. Milosevic copied the location and hung up, ducked into McGrath's office for instructions.
Check it out, McGrath told him.
Milosevic nodded. He was always happy with road work. It gave him the chance to drive his own brand-new Ford Explorer, which he liked to use in preference to one of the Bureau's clunky sedans. And the Bureau liked to let him do exactly that, because he never bothered to claim for his personal gas. So he drove the big, shiny four-wheel drive 5 miles south and found the wreck of the Lexus. No trouble at all. It was parked at an angle on a lumpy concrete area behind an abandoned industrial building. The tires had burned away, and it was settled on the rims. The plates were still readable. Ortho 1. He poked through the drifts of ash inside, still slightly warm, and then he pulled the shaft of the burned key from the ignition and popped the trunk. Then he staggered 4 steps away and threw up on the concrete. He retched and spat and sweated. He pulled a cellular phone from his pocket and fired it up. Got straight through to McGrath in the federal building.
I found the dentist, he said. Where?
McGrath asked.
In the damn trunk, Milosevic said.
Slow roasted. Looks like he was alive when the fire started.
Christ,
McGrath said.
Is it connected?
No doubt about that, he said.
You sure?
McGrath asked him. No doubt about it, Milosevic said again. I found other stuff. Burned, but it's all pretty clear. There's a .38 right in the middle of what looks like a metal hinge. Could be from a woman's pocketbook, right? Coins and a lipstick tube, and the metal parts from a mobile phone and a pager, and there are 9 wire hangers on the floor, like you get from a dry cleaner?
Christ,
McGrath said again.
Conclusions?
They stole the Lexus up in Wilmette, Milosevic said. Maybe the dentist guy disturbed them in the act, so he went for them and they overpowered him and put him in the trunk, burned him along with the rest of the evidence.
Shit.
McGrath said.
But where's Holly? Conclusions on that?
They took her to Miggs Field, Milosevic said. It's about a 30 miles away. They put her in a private plane and dumped the car right here. That's what they did, Mac. They flew her out somewhere.
Four guys, capable of burning another guy up while he was still alive. They've got her alone somewhere. Could be a million miles away from here by now.